American scientists at Cape Canaveral are preparing to launch our first manned orbital flight, expected to take place in mid-January. But Soviet scientists are also predicting new gains in their program for the new year. For a report, here is Russ Jones in Moscow.
According to articles in the Soviet press, Soviet scientists are working on plans to land an unmanned spacecraft on the moon. Later, according to these experts, a manned Sputnik will land there. And finally, spaceships will be sent to Mars, Venus, and other planets of the solar system. However, neither of the articles appearing in Pravda and Izvestia set any timetable for the flight. They say only that they will happen in the not-too-distant future. Other items on the Soviet space calendar are much like the projects already developed or being completed by American scientists. They include satellites for the relay of television and radio broadcasts, weather observation, and aids to the navigation of ships and planes. Neither of the articles gives any hint that a space shot or even a new orbital flight is in the making for the near future. Russell Jones, NBC News, Moscow.
Queen Elizabeth tonight honored more than 2,000 Britons and other citizens of the British Commonwealth. It was the semi-annual honors list of the Queen. Barons and knights were created, while lesser honors went to others who range in occupation from wine testers to opera singers. London itself welcomed the new year as an unprecedented 3 inches of snow blanketed the city. Road and rail traffic is almost completely stopped, and the London airport is closed after workers gave up trying to clear the runways. Weather here in the United States for New Year's Eve is generally good. Some parts of upper New York State, however, are digging out of more than 2 feet of snow. Weather was seasonably warm in Florida again, and in Palm Beach, President Kennedy took advantage of the thaw by fishing for 20 minutes. Robert Gorelski, NBC News, Washington.
Now, Phillips Milk of Magnesia comes in a new mint-flavored form. So pleasant tasting, even children take it willingly. And it costs no more than regular Phillips. Used as a laxative, new mint-flavored Phillips, like regular Phillips, gives more complete relief than single-purpose preparations, for it relieves both irregularity and any accompanying acid indigestion. And as an antacid, Phillips settles upset stomach in seconds. Get flavored Phillips Milk of Magnesia today. This has been Monitor News. Listen again on the hour for Monitor News, brought to you by mint-flavored Phillips tablets for fast relief from acid indigestion. Do you know how incredibly difficult getting through roadblocks has been for correspondents working in the Congo? Well, that's just one of the questions we'll have answered here in this half hour of Monitor. And if the question in your mind is, who is your host in this half hour? Here's the answer to that question. Frank McGee.
Well, we've done it again. The world has reached the end of another year, and we're about to greet the coming of 1962 with hope, as the ever hopeful race of mankind has always greeted the future. New Year's Eve, it's a distinctive night, and looking back through the years, you probably can remember how you spent many of them, whom you were with, what you did. But can you remember the state of the world in general on different New Year's Eves in the past? For instance, New Year's Eve, 1945. How different the world was. How much has happened to us in the 16 years since then. The war was over, but there were still casualty lists in the paper. Secretary of State James Burns had just reassured an anxious Congress that the United States had not given atomic bomb secrets to any other country. It was revealed from Hitler's last testament that he had thrown Goering and Himmler out of the Nazi Party because they had sought to make peace with the Allies in the closing days of the war. And the Queen Elizabeth was at sea carrying delegates to the first meeting of the General Assembly of the United Nations scheduled to convene in London. New Year's Eve, 1945. A crowd estimated at 1 million jammed Times Square in the most exuberant New Year's Eve celebration since the coming of 1941. The war was over. This was the thought in the hearts of everyone who cheered and shouted to greet the new year that night.
And this is Times Square in New York City. Ben Grauer reporting from NBC's traditional vantage point for the New Year's Eve celebration, the Hotel Astor. And I'm speaking from a second floor balcony of the hotel, right on Broadway, about 30 feet above the milling crowd below. I'm measuring the tones of my voice as a measure of competition with the crowd below, because long years of experience here have shown me that loud as this crowd is now, it rises to unbelievable heights when the moment arrives, because the star performer here, of course, is the crowd. And as I look south to 40th Street and north to 46th Street, I can see nothing but a solid mass of people milling around, jam-packed, elbows, shins, knees, body to body, trying to wedge into this center of the city, which is, for the moment, as the clock spins around, the center of world attention. Rockets are flying, yes? One of the youngsters has dared to send up a rocket down on 40th Street. It just arched in the sky, 40 seconds to go. The pitch picks up. Three or four of them have lit Roman candles. They're burning on sticks above them. Several have shot off firecrackers. 15 seconds to go. The pitch picks up. I'm sure you can sense the almost massive power of that cry. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Happy New Year!
The war was over. In Japan, Emperor Hirohito disclaimed his divinity and called on Japan to eliminate the evils of the past. The first boatload of bananas in 5 years arrived in Britain. The Lord Mayor of Bristol led a parade to celebrate the arrival of the cargo. And it was announced that the rationing of tires in the United States would end at midnight. New Year's Eve, 1945. Maybe you were looking forward to going to the Rose Bowl game on New Year's Day, to see Alabama's undefeated, untied Crimson Tide battle UCLA's rugged Trojans. Maybe you were at a party, or maybe this was one New Year's Eve when you carried through on your resolution to stay home. Perhaps you listened to the radio, to the Joan Davis Show, to Vox Pop interviews at the United States Naval Hospital in Bethesda, to Information Please, which had Gregory Ratoff as a special guest. Or maybe you went to the movies to have a comparatively calm New Year's Eve. You might have seen Ingrid Bergman in one of the three big pictures in which she was starring at the time, Spellbound, Saratoga Trunk, or The Bells of St. Mary's, in which she appeared with Bing Crosby. Remember?
Every time you're near a rose, aren't you glad you've got a nose? And if the dawn is fresh with dew, aren't you glad you're you? When a meadowlark appears, aren't you glad you've got two ears? And if your heart is singing true, aren't you glad you're you? You can see a summer sky, or touch a friendly hand, or taste an apple pie. Pardon the grammar, but ain't life grand? And when you wake up each morn, aren't you glad that you were born? Think what you got the whole day through. Aren't you glad you're you?
If you were in New York that New Year's Eve, you might have gone to the theater to see Anna Lucasta, Gertrude Neeson in Follow the Girls, The Song of Norway, or Bloomer Girl, the story of the first suffragettes. Remember the music from that show?
Bright as the rain that falls from above, so real, so right is our love. It came like the spring that breaks through the snow. I can't say what it may bring.
It's right to believe whatever gave your eyes this glow.
Whatever gave my heart this song can't be wrong.
It's right as the rain
that falls from above
and fills the world with the blue. Oh, Lord.
New Year's Eve, 1945. A Bronx couple might have spent most of the evening on the phone calling up their friends. They'd been waiting for a telephone since the beginning of the war, and on New Year's Eve, the telephone company came through. Well, maybe you remember how long you waited for a telephone to be installed, and how elated you were when you finally got one. New Year's Eve, 1945. Were you still overseas? Were you at a party? Or did you stay home that night and listen to the sounds of horns at midnight drifting through your windows? New Year's Eve, 1945. Where were you? What were you doing? Can you remember?
It seems ironic that holiday times, when people are really enjoying themselves, are also the most dangerous times of the year for driving. The National Automobile Dealers Association points out that the combination of winter driving conditions and holiday drinking spells danger. Remember, don't go too fast for road and traffic conditions, and don't drive after drinking.
You're on the monitor beacon. And for 1962, another prediction. Statisticians say that about 3% of the babies who will be born this year in the United States will have red hair.
Monitor Sports, brought to you by Listerine, the antiseptic that kills germs on contact by millions.
And now, noted Washington columnist Drew Pearson with an important message.
I have reported danger signals from various parts of the country of Cole's contagion and increasing absenteeism from work and school. In my business, I can't afford colds or absenteeism. No matter what happens, I have to meet a deadline every day. Now, infectious germs in your mouth and throat increase a cold's discomfort, can make the cold drag on. But gargling with Listerine antiseptic does a terrific job of killing these germs by millions. In fact, in 12-year tests, thousands of people who gargle with Listerine antiseptic twice daily had fewer, milder colds. So, ladies and gentlemen, on that record, and as a Listerine user, remember, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. To guard against cold's contagion, take a tip from one who knows, and gargle at least twice daily with Listerine antiseptic.
And now, Mel Allen at the Monitor Sports Desk.
And a Happy New Year to you and to all our Monitor listeners. You know, one of the major surprises of the 1961 college football season was Minnesota. Supposedly weakened by the graduation of an All-America guard, an All-Conference center, two other regular linemen, and three fullbacks. But Murray Warmoth outdid the job that earned him Coach of the Year honors and a national championship in 1960 and put together a 7-2 record. He lost his opening game and his last one. The last one, he had a lot of fellas injured. But any case, when Ohio State refused a Rose Bowl bid, Minnesota accepted, anxious to try and atone for a defeat last time around. Now, tomorrow, the Gophers and UCLA meet in Pasadena. Here's Warmoth now with Monitor reporter Bob Goggin.
Murray, how are you celebrating the new year? Well, I'm feeling pretty good. Just a little nervous and waiting for the ball game.
How about the boys on the team? Are they out tonight, living it up, or are they going to have to take it easy?
No, I think that they're leading a rather sheltered life.
How does this year's Rose Bowl team compare to last year's squad, your last year's Minnesota squad?
We don't have the depth that we had a year ago, and we're a little bit smaller. We hope we're quicker and a little faster. I think the thing that made us successful this year more than any other one thing was that our juniors of last year coming up to their senior year have made more improvement than any senior ball club I ever had. And so we're a little bit thin and we're a little bit light. But I think that we have a lot of experience and our boys play with quite a lot of poise. And so I think that this is the reason why we were successful this last year. We had very few injuries, and our juniors coming up to their senior year improved a great deal.
Murray, who are the boys who were going to make the difference in terms of the Minnesota squad?
Well, I think that Sandy Stevens has been a spark plug for us all year, and any team that uses a T formation has to have a very capable quarterback. If they don't, they just are not going to win. So our big offensive weapon has been Sandy Stevens running and his passing. We have a fine receiver in Tom Hall that's caught a number of passes for us. From the defensive aspect, Bobby Bell has been a tremendous football player for us, and we've had fine end play all year. Bill Muncy and Dave Mulholland have given us good defensive halfback play. So if we're able to stop the team, it'll be because our ends play well and because Bell's playing well and our halfbacks are playing well. If we're able to move the ball, it'll be because Sandy Stevens is having a good day.
Murray, are you pretty anxious to avenge last year's defeat at the hands of Washington in the Rose Bowl?
Well, I think that if we were playing Washington, the revenge motive could be a great deal stronger. This team is very happy to play again. I'm very happy that our boys could play again in the Rose Bowl. But, of course, as you know, Billy Barnes and Deke Brackett, members of the UCLA coaching staff, are good friends of mine, and we're teammates of mine.
Oh, buddy.
Yes, I just love them, but friendship ceases when we kick off tomorrow, and I'm sure that they feel the same way. And we'll do our very best to win.
Well, Murray, we wish you lots of luck in tomorrow's game.
Oh, well, thanks a lot, and I'd love to take this opportunity to wish all of the listeners to monitor a very Happy New Year, and particularly those who are pulling for Minnesota, I want to wish them a Happy New Year.
Thank you, Barry. This is Robert Goggin. Now back to the Monitor Sports Desk and Mel Allen.
Thanks, Bob. And by the way, the Rose Bowl game will be aired tomorrow by NBC Radio and TV. Now, a word from Reader's Digest.
If you're a housewife, perhaps with grown children, who'd like to go back to work, be sure to read The Problem of Women Who Want to Go Back to Work. In January Reader's Digest, you'll learn that even if there is a double standard in business, some women can make more money than their male supervisors. This Digest article tells about five big areas with increasing opportunities for women. Don't miss it. In January Reader's Digest, now on sale.
This is Mel Allen again reminding you that for the best and most comprehensive sports news, stay tuned to Monitor.
In 1961, one area of the world certainly emerged as a focal point of trouble for us all, and that spot is the Congo. And so as we see the old year out, it seems appropriate to take a few minutes to talk with correspondent George Clay in Katanga about some of the problems of the area, and particularly about his problems as a correspondent trying to bring you the news as it happens.
Well, Frank, just a short while back I recorded some of the noises of this war in Elizabethville, and this is what it sounds like when one of the UN planes comes over the city on a strafing run. Every Katangese soldier in Elizabethville opens up, no matter whether he's armed with a pistol or a machine gun, and no matter whether the plane is just above the rooftops or a mile up. Sometimes I think this type of anti-aircraft fire is more dangerous for those of us on the ground than for the planes. But there's another war in Katanga for us newsmen. It's the constant battle for communications. You know the old newspaper saying that a story is not a story until it's on the streets. Well, that's our battle. We've got a story, all right, but how to get it out? Telecommunications lasted a few days after the start of the fighting. Then the UN blasted the radio transmitter and the post office and knocked out both the telex and the radio telephone link. We can still get short messages out on the landline telephone to Rhodesia, when we're lucky, that is. But most of the news of Katanga comes the hard way, down the long road to the cable and radio centers in Rhodesia. Of course, Africa's changed. We don't use a black man with a cleft stick for our messages. But looking back on the succession of hire cars that have given up the struggle on this road, maybe we would have been better off if we had. As it is, we shuttle back and forth along this road in whatever cars we can get, and hiring cars is not easy when they're not covered for war risk. It's about 120 miles from Elizabethville to the nearest communications center. That may not sound like much to you, Frank, but remember, this is the rainy season in Central Africa, and the rain here comes down in solid, blinding sheets. We have to plow through a lot of mud, and even when the road is surfaced by a covering of thin tar, it can be slippery and tricky to drive on. Then, of course, there are the barricades. Between Elizabethville and the Rhodesian frontier, there are an average of 5 roadblocks, sometimes more, never less than 3. Some of them are manned by regular soldiers, others by policemen. But the worst are the almost unofficial barriers put up by the irregulars, the militiamen. You come roaring round a sharp corner, and suddenly across the road in front of you is a row of oil drums. You jam on everything, stop just in time, and then out of the bush there comes a ragged, fierce-looking bunch of black men pointing a nasty selection of ancient rifles, shotguns, and homemade muzzle loaders. We've developed a technique for dealing with these roadblocks. It's what one newsman called the white man's last weapon in Africa, a wave and a sickly smile, and in this case a bit of pidgin French or a few words of Swahili. I switched on a recorder the other night as I came up to one of these barriers with a British newsman in the car. Here's what we sounded like.
Bonsoir.
Bonsoir.
Fingers. Nous retournons à demain.
Nous sommes journalistes.
Voilà notre carte de presse. Tomorrow.
Bon.
Would you like some cigarettes?
Yes,
sure. Packet of these. Huh?
Oh, here you go. Give them a packet each.
What?
Voilà.
Light. Good. There we are.
Well.
Okay. Good night.
Okay, good night.
Adamant.
What?
They've really got onto this cigarette racket now, haven't they?
Maybe we do sound a bit silly, but personally I'd rather make a fool of myself than provoke some trigger-happy warrior into shooting one of those things at our heads. The stream of newsmen going in and out has rather put up the ante now, and the various roadblocks are beginning to get choosy about the goodwill gifts that they are prepared to accept from us. When I go back this time, I've got to take an alcohol stove for the man in charge at the first barrier. The guards at the second want snuff. The next lot want beer. Then there are the 12 men at the final blockade. Apparently, they were sent out on this duty before they could draw all their equipment, so they've appointed me quartermaster. And before I go back, I have to find somewhere for them 12 green berets, because they're paracommandos, and they say that's part of their uniform and they must have it. This run through the barricades used to be a sort of Katanga roulette. You could never be quite sure whether the soldiers would turn nasty or not. But slowly, with all this bonhomie and beer and berets, we were beginning to get ahead of the game. Now there's a new hazard. The UN planes are out every day now, cruising up and down this stretch of road, looking for convoys bringing supplies in over the Rhodesian frontier.